Starting Overdrive. Real stories of starting over with Red Seaton.
Hey everyone, this is Red Seaton, creator and host of the Starting Overdrive podcast. Welcome to the new Starting Overdrive segment called Turning Points, in which I focus on significant, life-changing events directly connected to the process of starting over. Events, or turning points, that alter who we are, force us to change direction in life, and let go of everything we once knew. This segment is an exploration into life-defining, irreversible turning points that rock us to the very core of our being, and force us to accept change whether we like it or not. So many of us fear change in today's rapidly accelerating society. Change can be incredibly scary for many of us, especially with so much technology setting the pace of our lives. I'm fascinated by the ability we all have to embrace change and confront our deepest fears, especially when change is forced upon us through significant, life-altering events, turning points, and we have no other choice but to face our fears head-on in order to move forward. It's through these irreversible turning points that we truly learn who we are on the deepest level, what we can handle in life, the true power of the human spirit, and who we were meant to become. On many levels, who we thought we were before these major life-changing events was only preparing us for who we're supposed to be after the turning point. The following story is the most important irreversible turning point that changed my life forever. This story details the aftermath of an accident with graphic words that may produce traumatic imagery and be too much for the sensitive listener. Listener discretion is advised. The year was 1985. 1985 was the same year Ronald Reagan was President of the United States. Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister of England. Coca-Cola had just been introduced to the world as New Coke, which, if any of you remember, was one of the worst product rollouts and business decisions in history, and was quickly replaced with Classic Coke, the Coke that we still taste to this day. In 1985, compact discs, also known as CDs, just hit the music market. Super Mario Brothers was the top video game of the year. The Titanic was finally located after 73 years. Governments around the world were finally taking AIDS seriously in 1985. Bob Geldof of the Boomtown Rats and Midge Ure of Ultravox assembled the star-studded and now historic Live Aid concert series across the globe to raise money for the starving in Africa, while both Lionel Richie and Michael Jackson wrote and assembled their own star-studded musical lineup to sing We Are the World. The day was May 18th, a Saturday. Chuck Norris sat atop the movie box office with Code of Silence. Beverly Hills Cop was still in theaters, as was Rambo First Blood Part 2, Police Academy 2, and the James Bond film A View to a Kill, starring Roger Moore as 007. The same week of May 18th, 1985, Don't You Forget About Me by Simple Minds hit number one on the Billboard charts, followed by Madonna's Crazy for You and Murray Head's One Night in Bangkok. At the time of May 18th of that year, the most popular baby names were Michael for a boy and Ashley for a girl. Throughout history on May 18th, Napoleon Bonaparte became Emperor of France in 1804. Jacqueline Cochran became the first woman pilot to break the sound barrier in 1953. Apollo 10 was launched into lunar orbit in 1969. And the Mount St. Helens volcano blew its top in 1980 on May 18th. For me, however, May 18th, 1985 was the day that changed my life forever. In fact, it was the night that changed my life forever. It was a murky, humid night in Halifax, Nova Scotia, on the east coast of Canada, where I grew up. Halifax is a port city with one of the deepest natural harbors in the world. It's a small Atlantic city rich in history. Nova Scotia played a major role in the founding of North America. Halifax played integral naval roles in World War I and World War II. Singer Sarah McLachlan grew up in Halifax, as did actor Elliot Page, formerly actress Ellen Page. The Trailer Park Boys are from Halifax, sort of, as was silent film star Ruby Keeler and singer Denny Doherty of the Mamas and the Papas. Dreary and damp wasn't unusual for a Halifax night in May. What was unusual was the warmer temperature that night. It was unusually warm. On most days in Halifax, it's your typical windy, eastern seafaring city. Cold 9 months of the year, Atlantic wind, frigid, wind chill, lots of snow, but amazing hot summers. So, if you want to do anything in the run of the year living in Halifax and have some fun, you need to be able to brave the elements. You can spend an hour or more doing your hair, getting it just right, only to walk out your door and have the usual gust of wind give you morning bedhead in less than a second. On May 18, 1985, it was the weekend, a typical Saturday night that no 16-year-old boy wants to spend at home alone. I was 16, life was just beginning, and the only things on my mind were girls, music, girls, girls, sports, and having a good time. I mean, it was the 80s, and the 80s were a really fun time to grow up and have a good time. It was one of those nights when all your closest friends are either busy or don't want to do anything. So you end up calling everyone and anyone you can think of for a plan. And when I say calling, there weren't cell phones, and the internet didn't exist. So you had to physically pick up the phone attached to the wall and actually call someone. And because of that, it was also a time when people answered their phones. Luckily, it didn't take too long before I get a hold of a friend who invited me to a party with two other guy friends. I knew about the party from the previous day at school, but the people throwing the bash weren't my regular group of friends. I knew them all, but we weren't that close. The party was fairly far distance-wise from my mother's house where I was living. We'd be walking, so going out on this night would be more effort than usual. The crowd at the party were from a certain area of town, and I was from another, the adjacent community. Yet, we all went to the same high school. It was one of those awkward, territorial rivalry things, kind of like Cobra Kai versus Miyagi-Do, only a little bit different. And the guys who I'd be going to the party with weren't my regular group of friends either. I was more of a sports guy at the time, but a friend to all. Whereas, they were more insular, classic rock, and metal. And it's funny now because I'm more classic rock and metal today. So, my options were limited. It was either stay home, read a book, play Donkey Kong for the 10,000th time, or watch an episode of Dallas with my mother. Or go out with people I occasionally hung out with in the hope it would be a good time. Remember, it was 1985, no internet, and video games were really simple. Back then, the big challenge of video games was the gameplay simply got faster and sped up with each level. Gameplay just got too fast for a human to beat. And that usually ended in seething, rabid, teeth-gnashing disappointment that only complicated the frustration of being 16 years old. In 1985, reading books was still a thing. Physical books, like turning-the-page books, and a big form of entertainment. But, like today, a book could also put you to sleep faster than you'd like, and be a night killer. And at 16, that's not too cool. At least, it wasn't back then. So, off to the party I went, borrowing my friend's jean jacket to look a little more Van Halen or Def Leppard in order to fit in with the crowd. Looking back now, though, and I remember feeling it that night, I didn't fit in. The party wasn't that great. It was full of people I connected with as acquaintances, but not deeply as friends. I knew them, they knew me, but something was just off. Internally that night, I remember thinking to myself, okay, make the best of it. Talk to people, get to know them better, have a good time anyway. At least you're out of the house and doing something. Still, despite making the best of it, the night didn't really get any better. I also had that moment of regret. You know, that feeling when you commit to a plan in the moment, when you're excited, but when you actually have to make good on the plan, there's no turning back and you think, I wish I didn't make plans. At the party, I remember standing there, watching everyone mix, mingle, and talk. Thinking to myself, I should have stayed home and played Donkey Kong for the 10,000th and first time. Maybe reading a book might not have been so bad. It was a moment that I intuitively admitted to myself that I'd rather be somewhere else, that maybe I had made a mistake. The bigger mistake on that night is a cautionary tale, certainly a commentary on underage drinking. In telling this story, I can't exclude the fact that we were drinking that night. For me, it wasn't anything heavy or hard, just beer. But at 16, you're experimenting, without knowing your limits or even the consequences. At 16, you're really just play-acting adult, rather than being an adult, trying to fit in with everyone else who are play-acting adult. At the time, in 1985, almost everyone my age was experimenting with alcohol in some form or another, so I wasn't alone. The year before, in 1984, it was the first time I drank beer on my own with a group of friends. I was 15. Again, nothing serious. It was the first time I felt a buzz from a couple beers. Most everyone has that experience at some point. It's interesting to me now because I remember as a young kid tasting my father's beer and hating it, vowing to never touch the stuff. It was a beer called Olin Export Ale, brewed by the prominent Olin family brewery in Halifax. As a kid, I remember it being bitter and awful. And some people today will say it's still just as awful as it was back then. But going from a kid to a young teen, life has a funny way of altering your taste buds as you mature, especially when you're coming of age as a teenager trying to fit in with friends. Like I mentioned, at the time, I was more of a sports guy. I had no desire whatsoever to drink anything other than water or Gatorade or something natural. The leap from junior high to high school completely changed the game. It's amazing the amount of change that happens within a couple years. Suddenly, you find yourself at a party, drinking something only a few years earlier you hated and vowed to never drink in your life. And I have to say, that night, I wasn't hammered or lambasted out of my mind. I was feeling good, really good. But my judgment, especially as the night wore on, wasn't the sharpest. If anything, the beer made me throw way more caution to the wind than I normally would. None of us were staggering or anything like that. We had too long of a walk home to get that out of control. But I stuck it out at the party, had a relatively decent time, and the three of us decided to leave together. It was late, really late, like get in trouble with your parents late, later than any of us should have been out now that I reflect back on it that night. The four of us were off the beaten path of where I'd normally be had I been hanging out with my closest friends. We lived on the upper part of a hill within our community, whereas the party was closer to the bottom of a hill near a main two-lane highway. When I say highway, it wasn't a major highway like the I-5 in the United States or the Trans-Canada Highway. It's called the Bedford Highway, a local highway. In reality, it was just a busy two-lane road that was a main artery into the city. When the Bedford Highway was first built, it was more like a wagon trail or dirt road, way back in the early days when the city was expanding. So when it was eventually paved and divided into two lanes, sometime in the mid-20th century, it would have looked like a modern highway. The name highway just stuck throughout the decades. You could walk along the road. There was enough of a gravel shoulder in certain areas, but it wasn't consistent all the way into the city, and it certainly wasn't advisable to walk it in the dark. Streetlights were far apart, and, in certain wooded spots, there weren't any lights at all. And like I said, it was a busy road. In other words, it was dangerous. But when you're 16 years old, you're invincible, right? You don't think of danger. Well, I didn't that night, and it was a big mistake. Rather than walk uphill all the way, we decided to amble down to the highway and follow that until we could find a better place to cut uphill. That was also a huge mistake, because it was still uphill no matter how far we went into the city along the highway. Our collective thought process was that we'd get down to the highway and follow the sidewalk all the way up to where we needed to go. But when we arrived at the highway, it was another mistake. There was no sidewalk. There were parts of a sidewalk in spots, but it was irregular in areas, with dense tree lines that took away the shoulder and forced you to walk on the road without any protective space. You were literally on the road. What made it so dangerous was that walking meant we were forced to follow the road with our backs exposed to the oncoming traffic, which, obviously, we couldn't see. The four of us knew we had made a mistake without even saying it to one another, but we were committed. So we pushed forward and headed home along the highway as best we could, following what sidewalk we could, while navigating the tree lines in single file, and then walking four abreast on the open shoulder. Being so late at night, there weren't many cars on the road. The lack of traffic gave us a false sense of security, comfort, and, thinking back now, a level of complacency. Luckily, however, we made it through the most dangerous part of the walk to a longer stretch of sidewalk that would allow us to stroll safely past a more business district of the highway toward a residential area for us to cut uphill and get off the main road and out of danger. At least, that's what I thought and how it felt at the time. The last thing I remember is seeing the gas station ahead, a Shell station, on our right-hand side a couple blocks away. That was our goal, a marker of sorts. At the gas station, we'd turn right and head uphill off the busy highway toward home at the top of the hill, which was still a good 30-minute hike away. That's the last thing I remember. Everything went black. I don't remember what happened next. I still don't. Who I was in that moment was forever changed and gone. The following events, as I tell them now, I later learned secondhand from those who were with me, family, paramedics, doctors, and police. As we made our way toward the gas station, walking from the sidewalk, four abreast, side by side, we turned into the empty lot as a shortcut toward home. Off the highway, like I mentioned, the area was more residential. I was on the outside, closest to the road. And then, it happened. I was struck by a car from behind. I was hit by a car. In the blink of an eye, the night went from peaceful silence, with only the faint voices of four friends talking as they walked home, to sudden, sheer chaos and panic. If only it was a dream. It was a nightmare playing out in real time. We were trapped in reality, with no way out. One of the guys who was with me that night, when asked to describe what he heard, later recounted that the impact of the car on my body sounded like an empty garbage bag being hit by a baseball bat. It happened so quick that it was hard for him to describe the sound. Almost too hard. And really, when I think about it now so many years later, it was a sudden, shocking sound that he had never heard before. My body flew backward over the hood. My head struck the windshield, and the speed of the car propelled me 40 feet forward through the air, narrowly missing a lamppost. I landed on the pavement, hard, on my head, with a loud crack, on the right side of my face, and my body skidded along the ground like a lifeless rag doll, coming to a stop as the car kept going, speeding away in the distance, into the night. It was now a hit and run. One of my friends stood there frozen in shock, watching the car speed away in the distance, with his eyes fixated on the two red taillights that got smaller and smaller in the dark until they faded away into the night. He was a car guy, more a lover of cars as a hobby. This would play a pivotal role in the coming days, but in the moment, it was sheer chaos. There I laid, motionless on the ground, in a pool of fresh blood. I can only imagine what it must have been like for the guys who were with me. The shock, the panic, the urgency, the terror. They were also trapped in the same nightmare, but from a completely different perspective. In my mind's eye, I can only envision the moment in the same way you're hearing it right now. I have no memory of the incident whatsoever. My brain, thankfully, has blocked out the trauma. In the years since that night, I've come to learn more about how the brain works. When the brain registers an overwhelming trauma, it will attempt to protect itself by blocking that memory in a process called dissociation, which is a form of detachment from reality. I've often wondered if I'll ever regain the memory of those moments. But now, so many years later, I don't want to remember. I don't think about it anymore. It's the dissociation or detachment from that horrific reality that's allowed me to move on with my life. In some ways, it was a gift. As I laid there, bleeding, clinging to life, another one of my friends went into shock. From what I've been told, he immediately ran to the nearest building, yelling and banging on the door for help. By this time, it was well after midnight. The door he was frantically banging on was a business. The lights were off and no one was there. It was dark and empty. Obviously, it was closed. His brain was in protective overdrive because of the shock. It couldn't comprehend the reality of what was happening. He was simply looking for help on a primal level. Another friend ran to the nearest house for help, desperate, waking up anyone he could to call an ambulance. Beside the gas station, off the highway, it was the start or the lower edge of the community called Rockingham. That's why we were cutting through the lot. Up the hill, Rockingham transitioned into the community Bridgeview, because, at the top of the hill, it gave residents a picturesque view of the A. Murray McKay Suspension Bridge that crossed Halifax Harbor in the distance at the mouth of the Bedford Basin. Beyond Bridgeview was Clayton Park, where I was living at the time, and beyond Clayton Park was the community of Fairview, where I grew up and went to school. Like I said before, it was still a good 30-minute hike to Clayton Park from the Bedford Highway. All three communities at the time were middle class, family-oriented, domestic, safe, and great places to raise kids. Although I lived in Clayton Park, I played baseball for the Rockingham team only a couple years prior to getting hit by the car. In fact, the year of my accident, I played competitive baseball for the Fairview team. We were good, very good. The year following my accident, my team went to the national championships in Vancouver, where, ironically, I live now. Sadly, though, because of my accident, I never rejoined my team to make that trip. When it came to hockey, though, all four communities of Clayton Park, Fairview, Bridgeview, and Rockingham played together within the Centennial Minor Hockey Association. Kids in all four communities went to the same high school, so everyone generally knew everyone in some capacity, but were separated by community and self-identified with their community. Interestingly, looking back now at the night I was hit by a car, none of the guys that I was with played hockey or baseball. I've come to realize over the years, those three guys represented another side of myself, of my identity, that needed to be expressed beyond sports. There was a rebel spirit that needed to breathe and be free. Although the area at the gas station was more business than residential, there were people living above some of the stores. Lights were coming on from the noisy echoes of hysterical fear. People were waking up and witnessing the aftermath of what occurred below on the shoulder of the highway. Help would soon be on the way. It didn't take long for the police and paramedics to arrive. About 12 to 15 minutes. When I think about the events of that night, those 12 to 15 minutes must have been like a helpless eternity for my three friends. I'm sure time stood still for them, or at the very least, was in slow motion. When the paramedics arrived, I was awake and trying to move, moaning, making strange, unnatural sounds. Things didn't look good. In fact, things were dire, near fatal. Clinging to life, I was loaded into the ambulance and whisked away to the hospital, down the same highway into the darkness toward the city. The police remained on the scene with my friends to get their statements and piece together what happened. A 16-year-old boy getting hit by a car and rushed to the hospital is one thing. A hit and run is another criminal matter altogether. Failure to remain or return to the scene of an accident, and also failure to report an accident where an injury occurs, both offenses can result in jail time. Two of my friends were so shocked and panic-stricken that they didn't get a good look at the vehicle. The other friend, as I mentioned earlier, the car lover, watched the car disappear down the highway, its red taillights fading into the darkness. Almost immediately, though, something amazing happened. Even today, I'm astonished and grateful for how it played out. When asked about the make and model of the car, based on watching the taillights, my friend told the police officer he believed they belonged to a Mercury Capri. He couldn't be 100% certain, but he was as sure as he could be despite the overwhelming emotional confusion. I know the police pressed him hard for more information about the car, but remembering the taillights of a Mercury Capri was the best he could do under the circumstances. This would prove to be both profoundly significant and unbelievably amazing in the coming days as the police searched for the unknown driver who fled the scene. Now, for anyone who doesn't know what a Mercury Capri is, or hasn't seen nor heard of the car, it was made by the Ford Motor Company, but marketed under the Lincoln Mercury name. Between 1979 and 1986, the Mercury Capri was a second-generation counterpart of the 1979 Ford Mustang. The Mercury Capri looked like a Ford Mustang, but was uniquely distinct in its hatchback, vertical-mounted grille, and dark-tinted taillights. To the untrained or casual eye, or casual car fan, the Capri looked like a Mustang. This would prove to be profoundly significant. Sometime within the next few minutes, my parents were notified of what happened. It's hard to tell this part of the story because my parents were going through a nasty, bitter divorce. At the time of my accident, I was in the process of losing the safety and structure of my family. It's a completely separate story of starting over that I'll talk more about in a future episode. But on this particular night, my mother and father had already separated, and I suddenly found myself bouncing between their homes. My father was in a new relationship while my mother was starting life anew on her own. It was an incredibly difficult and painful time for all of us. My life was just beginning. It was my first year of high school. There was so much to be excited about and look forward to as I came of age. However, my life was falling apart, When it came to my family falling apart, there was nothing I could do about it. Change was forced upon me, whether I liked it or not. In the years preceding my accident and getting hit by a car, I grew up in a modern middle-class neighborhood. We weren't well off by any stretch, but my parents were doing okay. I was heavily involved in a variety of activities and organizations. I played sports year-round, hockey, baseball, football, basketball. I had grown up going to Sunday school. I was in Cubs, and then I joined the Boy Scouts. 4 years earlier, in 1981, I had traveled west to Alberta, Canada for a national scouting jamboree to camp and learn from scouts all across Canada, including scouts from Inuvik Northwest Territories, who exposed us East Coasters to their unique way of life. They were the real scouts in my eyes. It was an amazing experience at such a young age. Needless to say, I was busy for most of my childhood, with a lot of direction. My parents did a really great job of keeping me busy, active, and learning. I look back at that time in my life now, that time outside the home, with a sense of happiness and fond memories. However, all was not happy at home, inside the home. Although my parents gave me a lot of direction through activities outside the home, I can't remember a time in my life when they truly got along for an extended period of time. I mean, sincerely get along consistently, with long-term moments of true love and peace. Growing up, there couldn't be any more than 3 to 5 days of peace in the house before everything turned to chaos. I'm sure many of you listening can relate to this. The chaos would last a few days, usually with some type of upheaval, before things would turn nice again and give you an illusion of peace. Meanwhile, you're always waiting for the other shoe to drop and the chaos to return. You don't know when, you just know peace can't last. That pattern only intensified over the years until life was more chaotic than peaceful. A healthy relationship just isn't sustainable on chaos. It's important for me to say, however, that my parents weren't horrible parents at all. The reality was that both my mother and father had significant, unresolved trauma from their own individual childhoods that would prove to be the undoing of their marriage. Neither was equipped in certain ways to deal with their own trauma, let alone each other's trauma. I was forced to watch both of them unravel and deal with their pain in different ways. For whatever reason, they couldn't deal with their pain together. It's unfortunate because both of my parents only wanted to be loved and feel secure in that love. While me, as a child, I only wanted to be loved by both parents and feel secure in my family. It's tragic, really, how three people can live under one roof, all wanting and longing for the same thing, yet that goal is so unattainable and impossible to achieve. Looking back now on the night of my accident, a deeper reason why I was out so late, at a party, was that it was a reaction to what was happening in my life at the time. I was trying to keep myself busy. I was trying to forget the fact that I was losing my family and losing the safety and structure I had for my entire life. And because my parents' separation was so bitter and public, I felt a lot of shame and embarrassment at the time. It seemed like everyone else had the perfect life, while mine was falling apart. I felt less than. I felt inadequate. That night of my accident, I was trying to find something and someone to hold on to for security, because I didn't feel secure anymore at home. What makes this time in my life all the more painful beyond family and getting hit by a car is that I also grew up as a creative, wondrous little kid. I wasn't popular per se, and was largely bullied and tormented for being a sensitive kid. In elementary school, I always felt less than and inadequate. I spent a lot of time trying to be liked. It wasn't until junior high that I truly came into my own. I started to get bigger and fill out more. I lost that elementary school baby weight. I started to make many of the sports teams. I started to excel in certain sports like cross country, baseball, football. I hit the gym and worked my ass off to be in shape. I worked my ass off to once and for all become popular. I never wanted to feel less than others or inadequate ever again. In junior high, I was on top of the world. I worked hard to overcome a lot of judgment and stigmas. That's what made this time in my life so profoundly difficult. All of that internal and external progress I had made was taken away from me in an instant. In 1985, like I mentioned earlier, there were no cell phones. The internet didn't exist. Still, despite a lack of speedy technology that we're used to today, news and word of mouth traveled incredibly fast. especially on the night of my accident. Several of my friends admitted to me over the years that despite how late it was that night, they were awake in their beds, listening to the radio, when the news broke of my accident. They were stunned and horrified when they heard my name over the radio and learned that I was a victim of a hit-and-run on the Bedford Highway. Some told me they audibly gasped and shot up in their beds, unable to sleep, not knowing if I'd live or die. My father was the first of my parents to arrive at the hospital. It took him a while to tell me what he saw that night. I had to pry it out of him. I don't think he wanted me to know. It was heartbreaking to watch him struggle to tell me, but I wanted to know. It was horrific. I can't imagine what he felt as a parent that night. I don't wish it on anyone. When the paramedics rushed me through the emergency room doors, into the hospital, to the awaiting medical team, I was covered head to toe in blood, and my body was held down with a stomach strap, but shooting upward as I tried to sit up, thrashing, moaning, in obvious distress. There was nothing my father could do but watch in obvious horror and paralyzing shock, and try to comfort me with words through his own desperation for me to live. He was helpless, now also trapped in this nightmare of a reality along with me. He could only watch as they rushed me down the hall and into surgery to save my life. This was the night that changed my life forever. Stay tuned for the next episode of Starting Overdrive Turning Points, called Waking Up from a Coma, in which I detail the aftermath of my accident, my struggle to survive, and what it was like to open my eyes after spending a week in a coma. Also stay tuned for how my friend's recollection of the Mercury Capri taillights on the night of my accident played an amazing role in helping the police search for the unknown driver. Thanks for listening to the Starting Overdrive podcast. Join us next time for another real story of starting over. In the meantime, make sure to follow us on Spotify, YouTube, Amazon, Stitcher, and all major podcasting platforms. Head to the Starting Overdrive Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to our channels, help us grow, and feel free to share your story of starting over, or even let us know if you relate to any of the issues touched upon in our interviews. You can also find us at the Starting Overdrive podcast at the official site, www.startingoverdrive.com.